the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right. Well, we made it to a Friday. Welcome to it. I am Nicole Sandler coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com. We do it Tuesday through Friday from 3 to 4 Eastern, and we're heard on the Progressive Voices Network at 6 p.m. Eastern. And I thank you so much for listening to this program. Some days are better than others. Yesterday was a rough one. I got to admit, I'm having a rough time these days, as are so many of us. I'm trying not to be so tough on myself, knowing that millions of Americans are going through exactly what I am, what I'm feeling, the tenderness, the despair. And there's an old saying that it says, despair is not an option. Sometimes it seems like it's all we've got. I open the show every day with that wonderful piece that Boca Britt put together about the need for a free press in a democracy. And with each passing day, that's more and more apparent. You know, yesterday I tried to listen to some of your advice. Some people who called into the show said, turn off the news. It's really hard to do when you do a program like this that's news-based, where I pride myself on at least knowing what's going on, but there are some days it's just too unbearable. And then I think about the people who gather the news for a living, and I do it. I'm not a journalist. I'm an opinion commentator, but I do a program that is based on the news. It is fact-based. And I make sure that I do my homework and know what the hell I'm talking about. But there are some days it's just too unbearable. But then I go back and I wonder about the people who do this for a living. And our guest today is one of those such people. Now, I have no idea how today's show is going to go because honestly, I have not had time to read the book. It's not that I haven't had time to read the book. I haven't felt well enough to read the book. But there's a new book out. It's called Newsreel. A View Through the Lens When, by a guy named Tim Ortman, who spent 35 years as a cameraman and a producer and covered the news on the world stage. And I do know he bemoans the vilification of the news media. I mean, all you have to do is, and I won't assault your ears for too long, but you know, this is what we're up against these days.
Not you. Not you. Your organization's terrible. Your organization's terrible. Let's go.
Ask a question, sir.
Go ahead.
Sir,
quiet.
State,
quiet.
Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead. She's asking a question. Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question.
You
are fake news. Go ahead.
And we're running against a very dishonest media.
The public doesn't believe you people anymore.
And it's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write.
By the way, did you see all the corrections the media's been making? They're saying, sorry, we made a... They've been doing that all year.
He is a vile, sickening, disgusting excuse for a human being. He really is. He has turned this nation and the world on its end. And frankly, I hope... I mean, if I was a praying person, I'd pray that we can get out of this together. That you know, without too much damage done, that the rest of the world will forgive us, that we can put out a group hug and say we're really sorry. The orange vile creature was an anomaly and a mistake, and we are really sorry for foisting him upon the rest of the world. But I think I don't know that that's possible. Anyway, there's a lot of news going on. Before we get to it, it's Friday. I give comedians all the credit in the world. The people who make fun of this vile stuff that's going on, I don't know how they do it. There's a wonderfully talented woman named Lauren Mayer who puts out a video, a song parody each week. And, you know, God bless her for trying to make us laugh.
The French were once allies we loved, but our oldest pals we're booting, 'cause Trump prefers you flatter him like Kim Jong-un and Putin. We've kissed off the lands that are quite democratic, 'cause tyrants are now Trump's best friends.
They are.
His clicking with dictators is automatic, leaves our allies flat, but he'll smile at each autocrat. No more fights for human rights, 'cause on flattery he sure depends. Just say Trump's the greatest, then rule like a sadist. Tyrants are now Trump's best friends.
Sad but true.
There may come a time when we need our old buddies, but tyrants are now Trump's best friends. Democracy's history he never studies, he's at ease with sleaze. Who needs enemies with friends like these? Say ta-ta to Canada as our loving relationship ends. The insults to Justin have my poor heart busting. Tyrants are now Trump's best friends. Erdogan, Duterte, Kim, Xi, Al-Sisi, talk to me, Vladimir, tell us all what you've got on Trump.
Oh, no. Oh, no! Oh, I hate when I do this. I crashed my program. Well, you get the idea. I was trying to move a piece of audio. This is going to be one of those days. I was trying to move a piece of audio onto the program that plays all my clips, and I crashed it. I hate it when that happens. Hold on. Let's see if I can bring this up again. And see if I can't. Okay, well, you get the idea of that song. Tyrants are now Trump's best friends, Lauren Mayer. You can find her on YouTube and on Facebook and all those places. The thing that I was trying to pull over for you was a clip happened earlier this week. Ian Bremmer was telling a story on, I think, the CBS Morning News about one of the ways in which Trump dissed Angela Merkel. Just listen, you know, he kisses up to the tyrants, to the despots, to the dictators, to the strongmen around the world, Duterte, Putin, Erdogan, Kim Jong-un. I mean, you name it. The more evil they are, the more Trump wants to be their bestie. And so what does he do to our allies at the G7? Just listen to this story.
The relationship is about as dysfunctional as we've seen between America and its major allies since the transatlantic relationship really started after World War II. I've spoken with most of the delegations now that attended the G7 summit. And they've all responded that the relationship was very far from the 10 described by President Trump. They think it's deeply broken. Yep. They feel that their personal relationship with Trump is deeply problematic. And also that it's increasingly hard to find independent voices around him that they can engage with that'll get a message through, because they don't want to deliver messages that Trump's advisors don't want to deliver, messages that Trump personally doesn't want to hear.
There is that picture that has now become famous at the G7 summit. The Atlantic wrote that it's become kind of a Laurel and Yanny moment, with people having two different views of it. What have you learned about what actually happened in that moment?
Well, I think the background is important. It was at this point, it was towards the end of the summit, that Chancellor Merkel of Germany and Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada got together with some of the allies and really wanted to press Trump directly to sign the communique, the one that talked about a commitment to a rules-based international order. The advisors had been working on until 3 o'clock that morning, straight through the night, including Kudlow from the United States. And Trump was sitting there with his arms crossed, clearly not liking the fact that he felt like they were ganging up on him. He eventually agreed. He said, okay, he'll sign it. And at that point, he stood up. He put his hand in his pocket, his suit jacket pocket, and he took 2 Starburst candies out, threw them on the table, and said to Merkel, here, Angela, don't say I never give you anything. I would say that really showed if you want to look into what was behind both the body language there and also why it was that after the meeting Trump was so agitated and decided to tweet off against the Canadian Prime Minister and decide to pull his name out of the communique, completely unknown to Kudlow and others that had been advising him, I think that's really the reason. That's his emotional state at that point.
He's an impetuous child. He is a spoiled fucking brat who needs to be told no. I was going to say he needs a good spanking, but he'd probably enjoy that too much. Sickening. And this is why I've been feeling sick. I'm doing my best to hold it together, and I know I'm not alone. So, thank you all for bearing with me. All right. So what I was saying is we have our guest coming up today, Tim Ortman. Hopefully he'll hang and tell us some stories, even though I haven't been able to read the book. We'll see how it goes. But before we get to Tim, let's get to what's news.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
And as usual, things get updated from the time I record the recorded version of What's News early in the morning, so we'll do it live. Republican lawmakers emerging from a closed-door meeting late yesterday said leadership decided to postpone the vote on the second GOP immigration bill until sometime next week. Earlier in the day, they had delayed it until this morning, as the bill lacked support from conservatives and moderates. That's just about everybody, isn't it? It would provide a pathway to citizenship for undocumented young immigrants, billions of dollars for Trump's wall, and would allegedly keep migrant families together at the border. Meanwhile, this morning, Trump backpedaled, go figure, this time on immigration. Yes, he took to the toilet Twitter. Here's what he tweeted. Republicans should stop wasting their time on immigration until after we elect more senators and congressmen, women in November. Dems are just playing games, have no intention of doing anything to solve this decades-old problem. We can pass great legislation after the red wave. The red wave? He is delusional. Look, I'm not guaranteeing there will be a blue wave. The only way there's going to be a blue wave is if each and every one of us votes, and not only each and every one of us, but you all, take 10 people with you and hound them and make sure every couple of months they check and make sure that their voter registration is in effect. You listen to Greg Palast. You know what we're up against. You got to make sure we got to fight back against it. Anyway, more insanity to end the week as nothing seems to make sense in America anymore. Just a day after the president signed an executive order ostensibly to keep families intact, some 20,000 Yes, 20,000 unaccompanied migrant children are reportedly to be sheltered on U.S. military bases. This, according to a Pentagon official, following a request from the Department of Health and Human Services. Meanwhile, experts say the process to reunite detained children with their families is in total chaos, as is on display in this exchange between Freedom Caucus member Jim Jordan and CNN's John Berman.
And you said it's news to me that the administration doesn't have a plan to reunite these 2,300 kids with their parents.
The president signed an executive order
yesterday. That is not about the reunification. That is about what to do
forward. Let's work that. Let's fix that. But we also have to deal with the Flores decision, which is the impetus, which is the catalyst for why they're separated in the first place.
I just want to be clear. You want the administration to reunite these 2,300 children with their parents immediately.
John, everyone wants the kids to be reunited with their parents, but you have to sort it out. You have to do it in a way that's consistent with the law. You have to fix the asylum law, which is broken. Everyone understands.
You keep saying everyone wants these 2,300 children reunited with their parents. I just don't know if that's the case based on the answer we got from the administration overnight. I hope you're right. I really hope you're right.
And I signed an executive order yesterday. What else do you want?
There's nothing in the executive order. You show me in the executive order where he says any one thing about reuniting the people already separated. It doesn't. It just doesn't say anything about reuniting those kids with their parents. Also, there was an official, a spokesperson from HHS, who at first
You really think he signs an executive order saying we're not going to separate kids, we're going to keep them together throughout the adjudication process, throughout the whole process mm-hmm. where we're determining whether they legitimately need to receive asylum mm-hmm. or not. We're going to keep them together the whole time, but the ones that were separate, we're not going to bring them back together. You really think that's the case?
It's not what I think. It's what we were told. It's what we read, first of all, and then what we were told by an HHS official. I'll have someone hand that to me in just a second. But
and
the
if
first
that's
thing
the case,
we
have legislation pending introduced by Representative Meadows on the House side, Senator Cruz on the Senate side. Let's pass that legislation and deal with it.
Yeah, and that legislation now has been tabled. Yeah, it won't go anywhere. Oh, and by the way, Trump tweeted, Republicans should stop wasting their time on immigration until after we elect more senators and congressmen and women in November. Good luck with that. Immigration, anything to be done to help these kids from the these poor children who've been taken from their parents to the Dreamers is tabled until after the election. Welcome to America. Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who's running to unseat Ted Cruz from the U.S. Senate, has been to the border facilities, and he tells Chris Hayes that Trump's crackdown has only made the situation exponentially worse.
When you see CBP officers, and you may have seen this in McAllen and Reynosa, rejecting lawful asylum seekers from crossing into this country at an international bridge, thereby providing an incentive for them to cross in between ports of entry, and then arresting them, then taking their kids from them, they have absolutely created this crisis. This did not exist until Donald Trump, the president, and his administration decided to make it a crisis.
Well, the president said something I thought fairly astounding this morning about asylum. He said, we shouldn't be hiring judges by the thousands as our ridiculous immigration laws demand. We should be changing our laws, building the wall, hire border agents and ICE. And here's the crucial part, not let people come into our country based on a legal phrase they are told to say is their password. He's referring to asylum there that is enshrined both in domestic U.S. law and international law that is widely recognized across the world as a human right. What do you think of him calling it a password?
I think this is terrible. We know it's inhumane. We know what we're doing to these asylum seekers when they try to come to this country. And just to put it into context, Chris, if you go back to the beginning of the George W. Bush administration, you had 1.6 million apprehensions along the U.S.-Mexico border. Last year, it was something like 400,000 apprehensions. We have the capacity to address lawful asylum claims. We're the wealthiest and most powerful country on the planet. And those who lawfully belong here through a lawful asylum claim where they can prove credible fear, there's no telling what they will do for the United States. The jobs they'll create, the art that they will produce, the families that they will raise here. That's the story of this country, 230 years and counting, and we lose that at our peril. This is going to be decided right now. It's up to all of us. The president precipitated. He made this decision. Now it's for us, the American people, to decide it.
And decide it we will at the ballot box. It is so important to vote. And I know that so many people who listen have a problem with the Democrats. I get it. I do too. But the only way we're going to fix things is to get the Republicans out of power. Then we fix the Democrats from within. Those are our only choices. There is no third option. You got to hold your nose and vote D. It's the only way. Right now, during primary season, vote for the best progressive Democrats you can find and hope that they win their nomination. Beto O'Rourke, can you imagine him? And he is the nominee. Beating Ted Cruz, we can do it. We just have to come out in massive numbers. By the way, if you wonder what the difference is between us and them, I don't often turn the TV to the Fox. If you've been listening to this show for the last few days, you know how heartbroken I am over these poor kids. Here's what they're saying on Fox about these children.
Like it or not, these aren't our kids. Show them compassion. But it's not like he's doing this to the people of Idaho or Texas. These are people from another country, and now people are saying that they're more important than people in our country who are paying taxes who have needs as well.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That is the dictionary definition of a bigot, of a racist, of a person who does not deserve to breathe the air that we breathe. Oh, but let's get on with the news. Because it gets worse. It's. I'm glad it's Friday because I don't know that I could do. I almost didn't do a show today because I've been this. But we'll get through it. Okay, here we are. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has filed an emergency motion in court so it can lock up migrant children indefinitely, along with their parents. Earlier, Attorney General Jeff Sessions told the Christian Broadcasting Network that it's painful to hear religious leaders condemn the policy of child separation he oversaw. Because he's a vile, hateful piece of shit. But I digress. But the most absurd story of the week has to be the one surrounding Melania Trump's trip to Texas to visit some of the centers where the kids are detained. Stephen Colbert has more.
You know, the story of the week has been Donald Trump's pro-baby snatching agenda. And today it took another weird turn because to try to humanize these child detention centers, the administration sent their most high-profile detainee, Melania Trump. And as soon as she got there, the first lady cut right to the big question.
How I can help to these children to reunite with their families as quickly as possible.
Ma'am, I know how you can help. Unfortunately, involves speaking to your husband. But desperate times call for desperate measures. And the first lady got some details on how long these kids are detained.
How long is the time that the max time that somebody spent here that they reunite with the family?
The average length of stay currently is between 42 and 45 minutes.
That's great.
That's great? 42 to 45 days, that's great. My record for being gone is 25 days. Now, when I heard that she was doing this, I thought, okay, this is what first ladies often do. You know, you go to a troubled area, they see the children, mm-hmm. they show that we care. You can't mess that up. Guess what? I spoke too soon. Now, before we show you this photo, please know it's real. We checked it so many times because we thought this has to be fake. But today, on her way to show that she cares, Melania wore a jacket that says, "I really don't care, do you?"
Wow.
That's what they settled on? What was her first choice? A jacket that says, "Womp, womp." She's forgotten the most important fashion advice. Before you leave the house, look in the mirror and take off that jacket. But the first lady spokesman says, it's a jacket. There was no hidden message. Right. It's definitely not hidden.
Nope.
It's right on the back. And I'm going to guess this is one message she did not steal from Michelle Obama.
You think?
Now, I'm sincerely curious here. How many people would get fired for this at a normal White House? One? Five? The entire executive branch? Because in the middle of the worst moral scandal in recent memory, so bad that her husband backed down for the first time in memory, people who were supposedly on her side let her get on a plane with a jacket that said, "I really don't care, do you?" For the record, we do.
We do. We do. Feeling, breathing, caring, human being do. Human beings do. People with the name Trump don't. And if you needed one more story of the absurd, I'll just let Rachel Maddow tell you.
Washington Post is now reporting that throughout the 2016 presidential campaign, the National Enquirer tabloid and its parent company's chief executive, David Pecker, shared stories about Trump before publication with Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, for approval. The Post also reports that the Enquirer took ideas from Trump for stories about his opponents. Now, the Enquirer denied this today, an executive telling the Post that if it did happen, it must have been rogues and renegades within the company because the company would never stand for that. Now, this might not seem like the most important thing in the scandal swirling around the president's lawyer, Michael Cohen, but remember when federal agents raided Michael Cohen's office in April, they were specifically seeking records of communications between Michael Cohen and executives at the National Enquirer. And that raid was carried out as part of a federal criminal investigation. Today's latest revelations are a very good reminder that we still do not know exactly what federal prosecutors are after in the larger Russia scandal or specifically when it comes to Michael Cohen.
That is the truth.
That's kind of intriguing, though, right?
I hope there's something there, because something's got to save us from this madness. All right. Well, on to more encouraging news. We'll take a break. We'll come back with newsman Tim Ortman, author of the book Newsreel, A View Through the Lens When. Hopefully he won't be too offended by the fact that I haven't been able to read the book. But first, a look at how we're killing the planet with Brad and Desi in the Green News Report.
They called it a public relations nightmare, if released.
Blocked water study finally released reveals widespread chemical contamination.
Most of the food crops that we consume showed these nutrient reductions.
Increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere reduces the nutritional value of food. Plus,
the Earth is warmer in 1988 than at any time in the history of instrumental measurements.
It's been 30 years since Dr. James Hansen first warned Congress about climate change.
30 years and counting. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Scott Pruitt is trying to protect you from finding out water is bad. If it is, which it's not, because what study?
This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, they've been hiding this study for a long, long time for some reason, and then they decided this week, with everything that's going on in the country, would be the week they release it, I guess.
Yeah, that widespread water contamination study had been blocked from public release by the Trump administration out of fear that it would cause, quote, a public relations nightmare, and for good reason. The Centers for Disease Control quietly published that study online on Wednesday, and it is not good. As predicted, the study shows dangerous toxic chemicals known as PFOA and PFAS used in nonstick pans and other consumer products are widespread in public water systems and military bases around the country, and the study found those chemicals are far more harmful at far lower levels than previously thought. The study recommends that the Environmental Protection Agency set the safe threshold for these chemicals up to 10 times lower than they are currently.
So when they were originally blocking this report, they said it would be a public relations nightmare, but they're releasing it on one of the craziest, busiest news weeks, and that's saying quite a bit, that we've seen in a long time. So will anybody actually notice this study?
Probably not. And it's also highly unlikely that any action will be taken by the Trump EPA to address any toxic chemicals in the U.S. water supply.
Well, that part goes without saying.
Well, this week, the EPA faced a court-ordered deadline to propose new standards for chemical spills from industrial facilities. That was in the wake of a toxic coal ash spill into a West Virginia river back in 2014. The EPA on Wednesday published that regulatory proposal to regulate those chemicals and concluded that no new rules are needed.
Of course they did.
And President Trump this week rescinded President Obama's protections for the oceans and the Great Lakes that were put in place in the wake of the catastrophic 2010 BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Trump's new executive order instead orders offshore oil and gas drilling to be prioritized and calls for more industrial development in and around the oceans and the Great Lakes.
He's calling for more industrial development around these precious resources.
Indeed, he is.
Okay.
Meanwhile, a disturbing first-of-its-kind study has troubling long-term implications for the global food supply. Published in the journal Nature, it finds that rising carbon dioxide emissions appear to reduce the nutritional value of food crops. More CO2 does make plants grow bigger, but it turns out that too much CO2 is like junk food for plants, increasing production of simple carbohydrates at the expense of essential nutrients like protein, zinc, iron, and vitamins in staple food crops like rice, corn, and wheat, which are primary food sources for billions of people around the world.
So those global warming deniers who said that, well, even if the globe is warming, this will be good because we'll grow more food, plants need carbon dioxide. Even if they are right about that aspect, they are wrong that somehow this makes everything better.
That's correct. Finally, June 23rd marks the 30th anniversary of the day that NASA scientist Dr. James Hansen first testified to Congress that rising CO2 emissions from the burning of fossil fuels was triggering dangerous global warming. Here's Dr. Hansen's original testimony back in 1988.
Our computer climate simulations indicate that the greenhouse effect is already large enough to begin to affect the probability of extreme events such as summer heat waves. Altogether, this evidence represents a very strong case, in my opinion, that the greenhouse effect has been detected and it is changing our climate now.
30 years and millions of dollars in fossil fuel industry-funded denial propaganda later, all of Hansen's predictions in 1988 have proven roughly accurate. In an interview with AP this week, Dr. Hansen said that he wishes he had been wrong. While some actions have been taken and the transition to renewable energy is gaining momentum globally, 30 years later, global warming's impacts are no longer in the future. They are now.
For much more on all of those reports and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time. The more you ignore me.
This is a huge, huge issue.
And we're talking about it. The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, we are back. Let me get our guest on the line. Tim Ortman has been covering the news for, 35 years as a cameraman and a producer for every major U.S. television news network and the Foreign Press Corps. I think he's there. Tim, you there?
I am. Hello.
Hi, hey, Tim. It's Nicole Sandler calling. We're live on the air. I do this sort of commando style without a producer. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. And I have to start with a bit of an apology. I've been sort of under the weather for the last couple of weeks, and so I have not been able to spend nearly as much time with your book as I would normally have before we were to speak. But I'm intrigued by it, and I'm excited to talk with you about it. So I thank you for being here today. The book is called Newsreel, A View Through the Lens When, and it's really a front row seat to your 35-year career as a cameraman, as a producer, covering the news on the world stage. Yes,
it is. It's kind of a look back. It's a memoir of my time spent as a young staff NBC cameraman based overseas as part of the Foreign Press Corps, and takes place during the 80s, and which was a very tumultuous time for world news gathering. For me personally, it started with the war in Lebanon and concludes with the fall of communism and behind the Iron Curtain.
Wow.
And throughout that whole time, I mean, I think it was, you know, the network news divisions were at their zenith back then, and I developed a real sense of camaraderie with the other men and women that, like me, would cover news. I felt incredibly proud to be part of the NBC News team and the much larger broadcast news business. And given the climate that we're in right now with so much media bashing, when I went to write the book, I wanted to write more than a memoir. So occasionally throughout the book, I remind the reader that in a free society like ours, a strong, independent, uncensored news media is a really valuable tool. It's quite the asset. It's not at all the enemy of the American people.
Well, it's a necessity to a true democracy, and ours is under assault every day by the most powerful man in the country.
Yeah, it's, and I don't want to mislead your listeners here. This book is not a referendum on Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. It's a 330-page book, and he's not mentioned once. It's a look back.
That's good.
It's a look back. It is good. It is good. I think there's, you know, too much. I spent a long time covering the globe, and I think today there's far too much news originating out of Washington. Of course, that's the job of the Washington Press Corps, but the airwaves seem to be monopolized with this administration, and there's so much else going on around the world that we need to stay focused on that as well.
Well, that is true, but I can't imagine, if you look back on your 35-year career, a time that you can look at as, I don't know what word I'm looking for, as volatile as this in terms of life in the United States.
No, we're in untested waters here. And when I was overseas, Ronald Reagan was the president. And whether you were for him or against him, he certainly made a very strong coalition with Helmut Kohl in Germany, Margaret Thatcher in Great Britain. And they had a great alliance. And you know, not going back long before Reagan, going back to Thomas Jefferson, I think every president has at times bristled with the coverage they've received from the press, from the news media.
True.
But at the end of the day, at the end of their term, they all seem to realize it's a cornerstone of our democracy. And I love, you know, to quote George W. Bush, Bush 43, who was a popular two-term Republican president, but not always covered in the most flattering light by the news media. And after leaving office, you know, Bush said power can be very addictive and it can be corrosive. And it's important for the media to call to account people who would abuse their power. So sage advice. I think people should not lose sight of that.
No. You know, and it was, I had heard from those who covered the White House during the Obama years that he didn't have the best relationship with the media either. But I don't think we've ever had a U.S. president refer to the free press as the enemy of the people.
Absolutely. That's just, I think, anybody who works in the news business or who is interested in news and information, that makes the hair on the back of their neck kind of stand up and realizes it's a real misrepresentation. It's a grotesque twisting of the truth.
Tim Ortman is with us. Again, the book is called News Real, R-E-A-L, A View Through the Lens When. So spending time overseas covering foreign affairs, I would imagine you did cover news in countries where the press was not afforded the freedoms that that are enshrined in our Constitution that we don't necessarily have here.
That's a great point. I mean, I was fortunate that I was able to cover news on five different continents.
Wow.
And I saw firsthand a number of societies. You know, I covered a lot of people, places, and things. And a number of them, whether they were a communist, one-party regime, or ruled by a totalitarian dictator, the media was anything but free and uncensored. It was a complete extension, a tool for that one-party regime or that dictator. And mm-hmm. the people, there was no voice for the voiceless. There was no light being shined on darkness, and which is what true journalism, fact-based journalism, is all about. And whenever people are quick to bash that freedom, that First Amendment freedom that our founding fathers created for us, I'm very quick to remind them that, hey, you know, there are plenty of places where you can find a void of free information, and you don't want to be there. You certainly don't want to live there.
No. Although, you know, there's a question about what we're turning into now if we don't get a handle on it quickly enough. There's the term we've come to know as the Fourth Estate. In fact, Showtime just ran a four-part series based on the New York Times covering the first 500 days of the Trump administration called The Fourth Estate that was very well done. What does the Fourth Estate mean to you?
It's a term applied to the news media to watch over, in terms of watchdog journalism, the three chambers of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch of government. So the Fourth Estate was coined, was a term coined for the press that they would act in this watchdog journalistic capacity. And that's a good thing. That's where the press guards the public interest against abuses, things like corruption or incompetence or misinformation. Mm-hmm. And they make, and it's not just applied to the government, it can also apply to big business. And it makes these large, powerful institutions more transparent to the people who elect the officials. And it's been around a long time, and it's a really strong and powerful aspect, the job of the news media.
The media itself has expanded since the 80s, which is the time that you're mostly covering in the book. It was a different era then, and I'm like you. I've worked my entire adult life in radio. I think my first radio job was in 1979. So I've been doing it for a long time, and I've seen my business change. So where now I'm doing this show online from my home studio.
Right.
And, you know, back in the day, that was unheard of. You'd go into a radio studio and you had to do it over the airwaves. It was the only way to get the signal out. The medium has changed, and the number of people who are actually out there broadcasting has changed. When it comes to news gathering, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
My knee-jerk reaction is to say change is good. Anytime you offer the consumer, and we are news consumers, more choice, that's inherently going to be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
However, the approach to news coverage has changed drastically since, like you said, 1979, which is about mm-hmm. the same time I got into the business. And from the network standpoint, the news divisions were not viewed back then as profit centers. The networks were making their money, whether it was, you know, Charlie's Angels or Cheers or Seinfeld or Monday Night Football, they were making their profits quite handsomely through the entertainment division. But the news division was left alone. We weren't really ruled by a profit motive. We were viewed as almost a higher calling. It was a civic obligation to cover the news and deliver it to the American people. So there was a different approach than there is today. And there were, yes, there were three major networks, and CNN was just coming on the scene. And the anchormen, Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, they were trusted more than presidents. And millions
right.
and millions of loyal viewers tuned in to get the straight scoop on what was happening around the world every night and every morning. So that journalism is still being practiced today. I don't want to lose sight. And I certainly try and remind the reader in the book that that's still very much alive and well today. There, you know, Columbia Journalism is still handing out Pulitzer Prizes, and there are still Edward R. Murrow Awards and Peabody's and DuPont's and Emmys being handed out for excellence in journalism. So it's still very much alive today, but the landscape is so crowded now. And with online opinion and TV talk, a lot of this stuff, which is good, but it masquerades as news when it's not really news. It's opinion and talk.
Yeah, well, there's a weird phenomenon going on. In fact, you know, Donald Trump capitalized on this this saying that he uses Fox News, fake news. I've been using that term for a long time. Here, I've got a little sounder that I made up years ago that illustrates what I'm talking about.
Your original source for fake news, Fox News. We make shit up.
We make shit up. And because they've been doing that for years. But now what's going on is it's almost like a cottage industry where they're taking legitimate news. I've had my days when I've criticized the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and MSNBC and all the others, and justly so. But what Trump is doing is turned it into an art form, and he's taking things that are legitimate news reports, labeling them fake, and taking the fake stuff, the made-up shit on Fox, and calling that the only source for real news. He's gaslighting America, and you've got a good swath of the country who believes him. And so when you have a time when, you know, the real journalists are reporting, doing good journalism, and yet they're being told it's fake news. It puts you in sort of a conundrum, doesn't it?
It can be maddening. And I wrote a column about this. It was picked up in various papers about fake news was coined by Jon Stewart in Comedy Central as a satirical bit. And then it gets repurposed. And today, in that use, as it's applied to broadcast, mainstream broadcast and print media, I don't buy it at all. It's what it is a smokescreen. It's a diversionary tactic that is aimed at a story that's at its core true, fact-based news, but it may not be very complimentary or very flattering. So they label this fake news in an attempt to distract the viewer or the listener or the reader and move on to a different story that is perhaps more flattering. But just by calling something fake doesn't mean it's untrue. It's still truthful, but sometimes truth can be a bitter pill to swallow. And especially with this administration, they don't particularly, no president likes, as I mentioned, that is going to like that. But by name calling it, you're trying to discredit a truthful story, and worse, the entire, you know, malign the entire news industry, which is a terrible attempt.
It is. I just imagine Walter Cronkite rolling over in his grave, seeing what has become of his, most trusted profession. I mean, who would think of doubting something that Uncle Walter said? You know, he's the guy you go to
not
trust.
Me. Yeah. And right? Again, I would say, you know, you do, of course, you're going to get upset at some of the stories that you hear and the reporting that's being done. But it's by and large, the mainstream bedrock news media are still very committed to the truth and fact-based reporting.
So, Tim Ortman, I'm guessing that you're happy you were in the business when you were in it. I can't imagine today, especially covering presidential campaigns and such, is a very fun place to be covering news when you're being yelled at by angry mobs. What are some of your biggest stories that you remember covering? What were some of your favorite moments of history that you were a witness to?
There were so many. And when the book concludes with the fall of communism, and I came back to the States and continued for many, many years covering news in an independent category. I was a freelancer. I set up a production company, and I was able to work for not just NBC News, but all the major news networks. So it's been a wonderful ride, and I've enjoyed every aspect of it. But with regards to the book, there are so many stories in there. Some of them are serious. Some of them are humorous. It's difficult for me to say that I had a favorite story, but I had a most unforgettable story. And that was when we had bureaus in every major city and every capital around the world. So when that made us truly global, and when news would break, we were very agile. We could mobilize and cover news quickly. And that was the case when the BBC broke a story in Ethiopia and Chad in northeast Africa about a famine of biblical proportion. And we scrambled, got into this really impoverished nation, which was a challenge in itself, and then had to make our way, hire a bush pilot and make our way up to these really remote regions where these hurried makeshift camps for the refugees were set up. And when we got there, we were
really ill-prepared for what we saw. There was a huge, on mass scale, there were people that had crawled for weeks just to come into these camps. And they were very rudimentary camps because the word had just gotten out. And they came, they had nothing, the rags on their back. There were a few tattered tents set up, but the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders were setting up medical facilities. But it was horrible. The sick and the dying were everywhere. And the mothers, they were so emaciated they couldn't produce breast milk, and their infants were dying in their arms. And it, we were you know, just horrified by these images. And we eventually got the stories out and the pictures to the world. And a very benevolent society donated lots of money to for immediate aid. I think the United States came up with $400 million immediately, and Live Aid concerts were produced in England and Philadelphia, and came up with tens of millions more dollars that were drastically needed. And it was, those images are horribly unforgettable, but we got the word out, and it's an example, one of many, where the news media can really make a difference by reporting. And in this case, it was a life-saving difference. So it was very challenging, difficult to cover, but very rewarding in doing so.
Oh, I'll bet. As much as the culture of covering the news has changed over the years, the technology has changed as well. I know it probably applies more to local news, where in the name of budget cuts, they'll send a reporter out with their own camera, you know, like a one-person shoot. Did you fall prey to any of that?
No, it was at the network level when I was doing it. There was, you know, increasingly there would be focus on profitability, and they started closing some of their bureaus. But I always felt I had, you know, a full, it was very much a team approach, whether we were doing a huge remote for the Today Show that involved hundreds of people, you know, or nightly news in China, where we went for 2 months and really did open up a very closed country to our broadcasts. Or if it was just a team, it was usually myself, a sound man, a producer, and a correspondent when I was a cameraman. And they would always, we were sufficiently, you know, the labor force was sufficient to do the job at hand. But yes, you're right. There is more and more emphasis on profitability at a local station. They simply, as viewership declines, they don't have the resources, I fear, to staff it appropriately. And you know, I remember, you know, now you're putting, everybody's got a phone and they can shoot video. And, you know, the fear is that everybody becomes a journalist. And I'm reminded of Don Hewitt, the late founder and executive producer of 60 Minutes. When he was asked about citizen journalism, he said, "Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I also think citizen brain surgery is a really good idea too." So,
well, you know, how things have changed, because today, as you mentioned, everyone with a cell phone and a Twitter account or Facebook feed is a journalist or a YouTube channel. You know, and therein lies the danger. You can slap the word news on it like Fox because it's on cable. It's not regulated by the FCC, they can make up as much shit as they want day in and day out and call it news, and nobody's going to tell them that they can't. So there's that dilution, and there's that problem of trust. It used to be if news was emblazoned on a program and it was on one of the big three networks, you knew it was news programming. And there were regulations where actually had to be news. That's been diluted so much that you know, Alex Jones can put out a show and call it news, and no one's going to stop him. And there's, I think, a danger there.
There certainly is. And it used to be, still today, if you go to the New York Times, you open up the first pages of the, you're going to get news from around the world. It's news. If you go into the center section, It's called op-ed. There's opinions and editorials, and they're clearly identified. And I remember in local news when I'm starting out, the general manager at the close of the newscast would give his opinion, and it would be labeled. There was a lower third title that, you know, this is an editorial.
Yeah.
So it was clearly labeled that such. And as I mentioned, now those things are masquerading as news when, in fact, they're not. And it, what it means is, yeah, you've got more choices, but we as news consumers, we kind of have to be selective. We have to determine ourselves, unfortunately, but we have to come up and decide what's news and what's opinion. There's nothing wrong with opinion. I get up and, you know, I watch the Sunday morning talk shows, and I like opinion, and, you know, I like to see what's out there, but you can't buy into it. Like that's the gospel truth. That's factually based reporting, because it's not. And we need to discern one from the other.
Tim Ortman, has any story ever affected you to the point where you thought, I can't do this anymore?
Oh, well, years later, when I came back to the States and we witnessed all of this violence we as Americans inflict upon ourselves. It started with the Oklahoma City bombing trial. And then that was followed up shortly thereafter by Columbine. And now there are so many school shootings that there is a real concern. We don't talk about it much in the news business, but those of us that cover those kind of horrific things, you're oftentimes at memorials, and there's so much mourning, and these are young children, Sandy Hook and in Fort Lauderdale. So there is there's a lot of internalizing of PTS, you know, post-traumatic stress, where people are just now, who cover that stuff, are going to seek assistance and help, because it weighs so heavily, but yet it's part, you teach yourself that it's part of the landscape. This is part of the job. So yeah, it's no fun, but to report on this and get the word out, it's necessary. But it is very, challenging. And I remember before I came on, the last story I covered was the fall of communism, and we were in Prague, and we'd been there for 2 months watching these. You know, these people claim political asylum. They would go into the West German consulate in Czechoslovakia. Once they were on West German soil, they claimed freedom, and that the West Germans arranged for trains to transport these people into West Germany, into freedom. And it was amazing to witness. But the communists didn't want to relinquish control. You know, even after a couple of days after the Berlin Wall fell, the Czechoslovakian communists were still firmly in power, and they broke up a small student protest. There were a couple thousand students assembled, and we were there, and everybody was very violently beaten, and our camera was destroyed, but we got pictures out, and it made a difference. That Czech Communist Party, within days, toppled, and free democratic elections were called for within weeks, but it was a head scratcher. I didn't enjoy getting roughed up by the communist police, and I wondered, you know, what we were doing. But when we saw that it helped to bury the communist regime there and others, it made it feel like it was worthwhile.
Right, I hear you. Right now, I'm having a hard time dealing with the stories about the kids being held, you know, taken from their parents. It's just it's hard to cover day in and day out. It's, you know, wondering what the hell's going on in our world. Anyway, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I agree. It's difficult to watch, let alone difficult to cover.
Yep.
I can only imagine and empathize with those, what the dedicated journalists who are covering this, the implementation of this kind of cruel policy, and doesn't really have a whole lot of support, but yet it's going forward.
Well, Tim Ortman, you got out of the news game and you got into the appreciation of wine. I'm sure that's a lot more satisfying in many ways.
It was it's been, I've been able to straddle both as a freelancer. Yes, I, I I got bitten by the wine bug in my 20s when I lived overseas and was based in Europe, in Germany and Italy. And I carried that appreciation throughout the rest of my life. And when I needed a break from news, I did go in and became a sommelier just kind of pursued that line of work and had a wonderful time. But there were always news projects that were calling, and I was able to kind of go between one and the other and really follow my two passions, which has been, I've been very fortunate to do that.
That's very lucky. Tim Ortman, again, the book is called Newsreel, A View Through the Lens When. I'll put a link up on the blog at NicoleSandler.com. Tim, thank you so much. It was wonderful talking with you. I really appreciate your time, and congratulations on the book.
Well, you're very welcome, and the thanks is all mine for having me on here. This has been very enjoyable.
Great. For me, too. Thanks so much. All right. With that, we are done for the week. Hang in there, everyone. Try to, we'll get through it together. Have a great weekend, everyone.